This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. On today's roundtable, the Bush administration tries a new approach. Donald Rumsfeld makes some internal changes at the Pentagon. And since this is the season of giving, whatever happened to thank you notes? Joining us today to discuss these topics from our headquarters in Washington, economist and author Julianne Malveaux, who is president and CEO of Last Words Productions Incorporated. Julianne, nice to talk to you.
Good to be here.
In Sweet Home Chicago, we have Laura Washington, columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times. Laura, nice to see you.
Happy New Year.
And George Curry, editor-in-chief of the newspaper, National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service, is in Laurel, Maryland. George, nice to have you back with us again.
Hello, Tony.
Man, we have so many topics to hit. We're going to jump right into the Bush changes, as it were. You know, a year ago, the issues were Iraq, of course, the reform of Social Security, the tax code, court-clogging litigation, the president's mantra at the time, my way or the highway. Come forward. We still have Iraq. Now we've got troop reduction, the Patriot Act, midterm elections, some things with the Supreme Court, and a number of scandals hovering around the Republican Party. So, George, they had to have a new strategy, didn't they? And is it how different is it?
Well, when they were rock bottom, they had, and I think the major change has been Bush, which is very hard for him to do, had to acknowledge some mistakes, and while at the same time, prompted by Karl Rove, engage in an active political-type campaign against his critics. It was a dual track, and Karl Rove may have lost some of his influence because he didn't want him to be contrite at all. He just wanted to go and just attack your critics. And apparently, from the stories we're reading, some of the younger advisors are saying, look, you got to show some kind of contrition while at the same time attacking your opponents.
Julianne, you know, we did have the president address the nation on the 18th of December, but does one speech make for a true shift in policy?
Not at all, but you know, the humility seems to work. You had both Democrats and Republicans completely outraged by the myopia that this man had operated through, especially around our losses over, you know, 2100 in Iraq. And so the contrition really does work for Republicans. It doesn't work for Dems. And Dems seem to be stepping up just a little bit in terms of talking about alternatives in Iraq. However, you know, he can put humility. You can sugarcoat, you know what, mm-hmm. but you can't change it.
Well, that's true.
And at the end of the day, he's still being hardline on Alito. He is still doing a number of other things. He lost a lot of political capital with Social Security, and he's trying to regain some of that. This is a pivotal year for his party. 2006, every congressional seat up, 33 senatorial seats up, 36 gubernatorial seats up. And so he's got to do something to redeem himself.
Laura Washington, I would think that this is also a critical year for the Democrats. Now put yourself in their shoes for a moment. You're trying to find chinks in the armor, and you have been unsuccessful at doing it year after year after year. Is this the year that they might be able to have a real breakthrough?
Yeah, I think that, Tony, I think that the Democrats already have the Bush administration down. As a matter of fact, I think you're going to see this administration not being as expansive as they thought they could be coming into this second administration because of the wounds they've suffered. They're going to have to take baby steps. The State of the Union speech next month, you're not going to see him making massive claims or massive proposals like changing Social Security as he has done in the past. He's going to have to assert small changes. And that's an advantage for the Democrats if they can then respond with a bigger picture response. I think another issue here that's sort of been discussed already is this issue of him owning up to his mistakes and taking some personal responsibility. And while I agree with Julianne that he has seemed a little bit contrite, he hasn't really stepped out there and said, "It's the buck stops at my desk. This is my my responsibility, and I need to own up to it." And I think the Democrats still have some room to maneuver in sort of pushing him in that direction. Remember, the Republicans are always the ones that talk about taking personal responsibility for social issues in terms of the way government is functions. And so put your money where your mouth is.
Mm-hmm. Like you mentioned small changes. That's our topic, too, for today's roundtable. Succession shakeup at the Pentagon. I don't know how significant this is, George Curry, in terms of who is going to succeed whom with regard to Donald Rumsfeld in the case of a disaster or an emergency. How big a deal is this?
It's not a big deal if you're looking at what happens if something suddenly happened to the Secretary of Defense, because the number two person goes there, and after that there have been a whole lot of changes. But what essentially happens is you got political operatives, people who are top advisors to the Secretary now, who was also top advisor to Dick Cheney when he was secretary, now in position above the various secretaries for the various branches. Therefore, they are in a better position to assert political control and really focus in control on that whole apparatus under Don Rumsfeld. That's the significance of it.
So, Julianne, so that this is not too inside baseball, are we looking basically at a shift policy-wise in the event that something were to happen, that the people that would succeed the secretary are on the same team as he is, so to speak?
Well, they may be on the same team he is, but I go back to the early part of the Bush administration when you had Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, Rumsfeld, and Cheney pretty much at each other's throats. I think that there are elements of replicating that situation here. Rumsfeld, it seems to me, is consolidating power. This is not so much as a policy change as it seems to me to be a yielding to Rumsfeld's, I wouldn't say supremacy, but to his power position. The whole notion that they're shifting focus in terms of our defense, when we already know how vulnerable we are, not only internally but externally, seems to be, it is inside baseball at some level, mm-hmm. but it's outside baseball in terms of the extent to which every American, whether you're in Des Moines, Iowa, in Honolulu, Hawaii, or in Washington, D.C., remains vulnerable.
Let's move on to topic number three, Jack Abramoff. How big, Laura Washington, coming to you first, how big a problem is Jack? And if I'm a member of Congress and I'm on the Hill and I've had some dealings with him, even minor dealings, how afraid am I?
I'm terrified. I'm absolutely terrified. And the fascinating thing about this case is if you read it about it and follow all the ins and outs of his rise to very rapid rise to power, it's clear that this was coming for a long time. It was clear, and folks who were close to him have even said that they thought he was getting too greedy, that he was pushing too hard. So these folks on Capitol Hill, those who are out there shaking in their boots because they've had dealings with him and may be under investigation, have only themselves to blame. Everybody knows who the tough players are in Washington, just as I know who the tough lobbyists are here. And you know the ones who cross the line. And if you're smart and ethical, you stay out of the way. But I think what happened here was that greed rose above all. This man was throwing a lot of money around, and a lot of folks inside and outside government couldn't resist it.
George Curry, let me ask you, who benefits if he cuts a deal before his scheduled trial in Florida next week?
Maybe those very members who are shaking their boots right now. Mm-hmm. This is a huge potential scandal. Here's a person here who really knew how to mix money and politics. In fact, I would say he was more powerful than many of the people who were elected to office. He fashioned himself as a godfather, would go along mimicking the godfather, you know, just saying, because he's had that strong power. And he has given millions to millions of various campaigns, basically money he got from casinos run by in Native American tribes that he blatantly misled and lied about. So he had these big sky boxes, all the major sports events that all the congressperson and senators frequented. He could bring down half of the Congress, probably.
You know, Julianne, go ahead.
You know, there are two scary things about this man, though, for me. One is his willful manipulation of Indian elections. Saginaw Chippewa election in 2001. The man said, you know, we're going to put everything behind this guy because he's a fan of ours. There is documentation. Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell gave an overview statement on September 29th to the Committee on Indian Affairs in which he outlined some of the things, and these are the things that haven't bubbled up into the media. The manipulation of Native American affairs is something that I think we ought to all be paying attention to because of the issues around Native American gambling, about the way that money is distributed, and about the potential for social and economic development among tribes that have already been exploited. This man came in and was billing $150,000 a month for 2 and 3 hours of work.
Mm-hmm.
But the manipulation of elections really oversees that. The other piece of it that I think is profoundly dangerous is the comments that we've been getting from some members of Congress that this is just business as usual. Now, many have been outraged, and as Laura says, some are shaking in their boots, but there are others who are prepared still to defend the K Street lifestyle of just buy what you want and who you want.
You know, that, that right to the point that I was going to bring up, as a matter of fact, the system allowed him to do this. If you disagree, please say so. But the system allows a person like this to operate in this fashion. And although he may go down, I have not read, heard, or seen anything that suggests that the system that allowed this is going to be changed in any significant way.
The system is set up, and he's set up for him to manipulate, as Julianne points out, the Indian tribes. Indian tribes have been exploited by just about every system that we have put in place since we came and took this country over from them. The way he used charities, you know, he was a big donor, a devout Orthodox Jew, a big donor to Jewish cause, a big donor to many other major Washington-based charities. That was because that put him close to the powerful people, people he could hobnob with and influence, and that is the way things work. That is the reason why many big-name, big-money people get involved in charities, so that they can manipulate them.
George,
but, you know, that this Greenberg-Tarig firm where he was, that needs to be investigated. I mean, people have been calling for a long time for an investigation of this lobby industry, which is worse than fungus in New Orleans. Mm. I mean, it just does not go away. These folks pop up and they basically manipulate their former legislators. You see someone, they lose an election. Next thing you know, they're buying their former colleagues. You can pass laws that say you can't take more than $25, which means, okay, you can't go to dinner. But what can you do? And this is the investigation that needs to take place, and quite frankly, the R's are more vulnerable than the D's are on this, and so that investigation ain't gonna happen anytime soon.
We're talking about gifts, and let's move to another form. Let's transition into another form of gift giving.
That was masterful, Tony. That was very good.
You like that?
I like that.
It is the season, after all, and people are giving gifts, and this came up in the office the other day because someone made a point that they had given a gift to someone and had not received a thank you note, a thank you call, hey, I got it, hey, thank you, I appreciate it. This seems to be a problem these days, at least in the circles that I've been traveling in. I'd like to hear from all of you. Is this an issue? Are people, they just don't have manners anymore? What's going on?
I think that's partly true. I think we do see a de-emphasis of manners. Our office is over at Howard University School of Communication, NNPA News Service, and sometimes when I'm entering or going out, if I'm with a female companion, I'm opening the door, and students look at me, several have even commented, like, you open the door? I say, yeah. And I have three sisters, and if they're all, two of them are married. I said, if they were dating somebody, if they didn't open the door, they better not come by the house. I mean, just basic things that were ingrained in us, we've gotten away from. And it's basic courtesy and manners.
Well, what about that, Julianne? Have you gotten thank you notes for your gifts that you gave to people?
Not really, but I do bug people, and I send them. I'm a writer. I love the printed word, and I love stationery. So I love sending thank you notes. It's just a way of expressing yourself to people, but a lot of people don't do it, and this email culture erodes it. I actually sent someone something that was very nice and, you know, a little pricey, and my girl sent me back an email, gee, thanks. I'm like, excuse me? You won't be getting anything from me anytime soon. I mean, an email, but that, you know, we live in a much more casual society, and so I think that it's on us, you know, you lead by example, and often when I send a thank you, people will call me and say, gee, I haven't gotten a written note like that in a long time, and I hope that that motivates them to do that later.
You know, I'm going to make an admission here before I come to you, Laura Washington, I can't believe I'm really admitting that. I did not know that you were supposed to send thank you notes for Christmas gifts.
Did you think you were supposed to do?
Well, call somebody and say thank you. But, you know, a formal note for a Christmas gift was not something that I ever thought was something that you had to do, because Christmas was supposed to be about, you know, giving. And once a person gave, that was their that was their gift.
You off my list, Tony.
Laura Washington, why don't you check?
Tony, it's never too late to learn. We can give you a lesson here. Whenever someone does something nice for you, ideally, and I'm not talking about just opening the door, as George says, that's something that's passed by the way, but you should always acknowledge it. You go to someone's house for dinner, someone brings you a gift, someone does something nice for you. I think Julianne's point about writing is really important here. We don't know how to write, you know, really write like they used to do in the Stone Age anymore. We were all computer literate now, so we don't know how to take out a piece of paper and write longhand. I've done a lot of fundraising over the years. I've served on boards, done fundraising for organizations I've been associated with, and I'm the recipient of a lot of requests, and I always make it a point to write a longhand note on just not some cardboard, but on a nice piece of stationery in every occasion. And like Julianne says, it really makes you special, so you get more attention. So if people don't want to be etiquette savvy, that's fine with me because it gets me more attention and gets me more appreciation because I do it.
Are black folks any different than anyone else in your experience when it comes to this kind of thing, you know, acknowledging and sending gifts, especially sending thank yous, especially written notes?
We have more of an oral tradition, and so in that sense, I think we're much more likely to pick up the phone and call, or we're much more likely to do something in person. But I think that comes down to, I think black folks have to be as responsive because we have to, as always, do better than everybody else. And I think that comes down to the way we raise our children. I think a lot of children are not being trained or being passed on to do this really real simple courtesy.
You know, I was just thinking of the words home training when I was a kid. Of course, my mother is like from the total old school. Mm-hmm. You know, we sat down after Christmas and she gave us the cards. And we had to sit there before we could use the toy and write the thank you. I'm not sure that, and Harriet Cole has done a great job in our community in talking about how to be and what, you know, just talking about etiquette. But I'm not sure that African-American parents, and I'm especially concerned about middle class, semi-affluent parents mm-hmm. who aren't teaching their kids how to say thanks. So that I know kids who get 15, 20 toys over the holidays, they forget about them. They don't even sit down to say, thank you, it was nice, I used it for this,
right.
It was for a school project.
That's right.
So if black folks aren't doing it, guess what? Black folks need to. Gratitude is just so central to the way we should live our lives, and it's just so central to claiming our blessings.
Absolutely. I'm going to end this. In Washington, economist and author Julianne Malvo, president and CEO of Last Word Productions. We've also been joined by Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist, and George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association. Let me just say to all of you, thank you. Your notes are in the mail.
Happy New Year.